Our housing crisis weighs heavily across the state. This morning, Eric Gill, leader of the Hotel Workers Union, joined us to talk about how Marriott Hotel may be warming to the idea of helping its employees buy a home with help from a housing trust fund and a new mortgage program. The issue is being bargained as contract talks are underway with major hoteliers whose contracts expire July 1st.
Well, we have most of our large Waikiki hotels, that contract has now expired. So we are doing pattern bargaining. So we're starting with the big ones. The two biggest employers are Marriott and our Kilia properties. So that's a total of 8 hotels that we're currently engaged with at the bargaining table. And, you know, several more are waiting in the wings for us to get around to them.
And we had talked last week, and you indicated that there was some progress made on this whole idea of a trust fund. We've just gone through this whole workshop thing with this mortgage company. Talk about that.
Well, we've proposed, as I've been saying for months, that we would propose setting up a special trust fund to assist members in purchasing homes. And so that's a matter, you know, it's a technical matter of setting up a fund, and then I have to bargain to get the employers to put money in. And so that's on the table. And Marriott's expressed so far, you know, only Marriott has addressed that, although I'm quite confident Kilia will agree as well. So they've agreed to, to set up the fund with us. Obviously, the question is going to be the money. You know, how much money do we expect them to put in? And that's going to be something that we bargain.
Right. But the idea then is what? Then you can tap this money to help your workers buy homes without putting a down payment down?
Well, you see, it's the time is right for this, because with the NACA mortgage product that we brought in over this past couple months, there's no down payment needed and no closing costs and no points and no title insurance and all that stuff. So because that product is configured that way, it removes one of the big obstacles to home buying, which is the down payment.
Right, because that's huge. That's often the nut that most people can't crack, because it's so expensive just to live, and you can't save anything.
Right. And, you know, so in the absence of the NACA product, we would, you know, presumably the fund would, as other funds in our union have done, is subsidize the down payment. But in this case, there is no down payment to subsidize. So we can turn that money to other purposes. And with the NACA product, that money can be used to buy down the rate on the note. So in other words, the same money that you might have put in for a down payment could reduce your note, you know, by half, you know, down to a 2%, even 1.5% or 1% note over a 30-year fixed mortgage. And so with the NACA product, we can be far more effective in applying the monies that we bargain from the hotels to assist our members. And, of course, members may not be able to make, you know, if they're going to buy a $500,000 home, you know, traditionally that's $100,000 down you got to put. Well, people don't have that, but they might have 50, and if they can, they can also use that money to buy down the note as well. So we believe that once we're up and running, you know, we can remove many of the obstacles that workers have to buying homes, which leaves the remaining problem, which is finding a home to buy in this market where all the developers are building only luxury homes for, you know, basically rich people from overseas. And so how do we get somebody to build homes in our marketplace? But again, this is we have the tools now to do this. You know, with members, if there's 100 members with a $500,000 note each, you know, then that's the takeout financing for somebody like Stanford Carr or Peter Savio, or you know, there are developers that would like to build for the local working people's market. But the numbers are hard. So it requires us to have a good deal on the land. And so we've encouraged and kind of sponsored discussions between the state housing officials, Hawaiian Homes, and NACA. And we believe that it's possible for NACA, using this product, to also help people on the Hawaiian Homes list get into homes. You know, obviously there's leasehold issues and collateralization issues and all that kind of stuff. But I think with the will, there's a way, and we can do this. You know, and I think the initial discussions seem quite positive.
If you can maybe just step back and explain to our listeners about this mortgage program and the history of kind of how it got started and where it's used in other cities.
Well, this is this program and this line of credit, this mortgage program, is a it it's the product of working people fighting for it. And basically, NACA organizes working people to put pressure on the banks to live up to their legal and moral obligations. And banks don't generally do that. You know, the law says, and the right thing to do, of course, is to give loans to the people who really need it. The truth is, banks makes more loans giving their money to people who don't need it, you know, who are rich people who are borrowing money but can pay back at a higher rate and pay back quicker. So to get the banks to do it, NACA has put pressure, mass pressure. You know, they go to bank meetings when banks are trying to merge with each other. And Bank of America, for example, has eaten up a whole series of other banks over the time. And all the surviving banks survive by eating up their competition. So that's one of the places where NACA can put pressure, because the government requires that you show proof that you've served the underserved communities, and generally they haven't. So Bruce is a smart guy. He got smart people working for him. They do the research. They prove that, and they put pressure on the banks.
And Bruce is?
Bruce Marks runs NACA. And so he started this back in the 80s, and I've been working with him since the early 90s. And so, you know, it was a stretch to bring the program to Hawaii because of the cost here. And also, truthfully, you know, some of the bad actions of banks across the country weren't as bad here, you know, so there's less to bust them on. However, you know, it's very clear that the combination of circumstances on the loan side, the credit side, and the supply side in terms of the availability and the cost of housing, you know, that's the crunch we're in. So we can address the mortgage side. We have addressed that. Now we got to address the supply side. How do we get units built for people that work, as opposed to people who are just investing in second, third, fourth homes, you know?
And so where is this in place? Where has it worked?
Well, it's worked all over the country. I think we're 31st, 32nd office they're opening in different cities. So it kind of sprung out of our local union in Boston, Local 26. It kind of outgrew that Boston model, spread across the country. And now it's coming back home to the roots. So here in Hawaii, and they're off in Vegas right now with our local up there. And the local up there already has a housing fund that's been in existence for some years, and they've already got some money. So this is good for them, too. You know, they were subsidizing people, but they didn't have a mortgage product that gave people the deal. And
it's a new animal.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, also the thing about NACA is they follow the mortgage holder. You don't just give you the note and forget about you. You know, you're on the list. You're a volunteer. You have to volunteer. That's part of it. You got to help push the banks to get money for the next guy, too. And so this is a good alliance with the unions, because that's what we do. You know, and so, and for us as a union, it's a godsend. You know, it's frustrating. You negotiate wages, you get good raises, and it all goes straight to the landlords when they increase the rent, and people's lives don't improve. You know, and now with the Airbnb putting pressure on our housing supply, and landlords taking rental homes out of the inventory and turning them into illegal hotels, that puts pressure on all the renters. And so we're looking at that. We want to secure our people's future. And the way to do that is get them in their own homes so they're not subject to those pressure from the rental market.
Right, and the hoteliers are really enjoying the record numbers now, and they're raising their room rates.
Well, it's not only that. Yes, they are, and Hawaii is at the top of the list in terms of room rates and profitability. And, of course, we're a 24/7, 365 operation, unlike, you know, cities like Chicago and Boston, which, you know, kind of go dark in for the hotel industry during the winter months. That's our strong time. You know, we're strong all year. And so they're making great money here. And but in addition to that, you know, the Republican Congress and this president guy we have, you know, did this tax bill, and they gave them hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars and free from our tax money in earlier this year when they passed that so-called Trump's greatest accomplishment, passing this tax bill that stripped billions of dollars off of working people's tax money, money we're going to need to support our health, our Medicare, and our Social Security just a few years down the road. and they give it to these corporations. You know, it's just a windfall. Well, okay, we can't stop this corporate anti-worker Congress from stripping off our tax money. We don't have the strength to do that. But we have the strength here to get some of that money back in our pockets through our collective bargaining.
So now the whole workshop sessions that you did this month, and I think a part of June, you mentioned you had about 1,500 people turn out. There's great interest in this. The question is, you know, how many of your members or the people that attended can qualify under this program?
Well, the fact is, you know, what NACA says and what NACA does is, you know, if you join the program, they will work with you and get you there. You know, obviously, you know, NACA or anybody else, if they're lending money, they have to get it back. You know, I mean, you go out of business real quick if you don't get the money back when you lend money, right? And that's true for NACA or anybody else who handles loans. And so they have to have underwriting standards. You know, you have to be able to afford the note.
Right.
And but you know what they do is they've basically worked with the banks to amend those underwriting standards in such a way that it's more favorable to working people.
So that it can work.
For example, they don't look at your credit check. They don't care. It's whether you can pay your rent. So you might have missed your cell phone payment, or you might have missed your credit card payment when you went and bought clothes or something. But if you pay your rent every month, it proves you can afford the note because you're paying your rent. And typically the note payment is going to be similar to your rent. That's one of the advantages, well, one of the few bright sides of having our very high rental costs, which is our people are already struggling to pay the rent. But they could take that same amount and buy, and instead of, you know, throwing their money down the tube, they can build their equity and build wealth for their generations.
And then our partners at Civil Beat, I know, did a story on this, and they did talk to economist Paul Brubaker, who, you know, wasn't wild about this idea. He thought that our efforts would be better spent through developers. We did have another economist in studio last week, Sumner LaCroix, who thought it was a great idea. He didn't think that you were going to do, you know, great numbers, but at least you were trying to make a dent with our housing crisis.
I've been in meetings with Paul. Paul believes that the market will solve everything, and that's long been proved to be untrue. The market here solves problem of third and fourth houses for rich foreign people trying to park their money in Hawaii real estate in American dollars. That's who the market is serving.
Right, but little for the working people.
Of course
the working
not,
class.
Because you know you have to adjust the market, which means you have to, in this case, you have to put pressure on the banks to extend credit, and that's what this program does.
When you were in our studios talking with us a few months ago, we were talking about the panic buttons. You know, that whole issue that's emerged with unions across the country, it was highlighted because of the false missile alert that we had back in January. And at that time, you talked about, you know, the hotel housekeepers aren't allowed to have phones. And so where are we at with that whole issue?
Well, look, you know, it's first of all, I mean, the employers are responding as they have to. You know, I mean, I think in terms of the panic button per se, that they're just taking that piece. I think the employers will commit to doing that. You know, it's for their own protection as well. The question is how they're going to do it. How's it going to be done? How's it going to be impacted? All that stuff. We have yet to really engage with them. Some employers say they've done it, and all it is a button that makes a loud noise. And, okay, if you're alone on the floor, a loud noise is not going to do you much good. Does it hook up? How does it hook up? What Marriott has said is that they're intending to roll this out, and in North America at least, and they're working on the systems to do it. And
so you have agreement with one hotelier?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have a proposal on the table. They basically said, look, we're going to do that. You know, so, okay, well, we want to see how and what and where and why, you know, and how that's going to work. But I don't think the concept itself isn't going to be the problem. The devil's going to be in the details, I think.
Okay. And then we did also talk about robotics and the use of that in the hotel. So where's that going?
Well, it's happening fast, you know, and robotics is just too simplistic a way to look at it. It's really, it's more app-driven at this point. So, you know, Marriott, for example, is already advertising that they can, you know, that through their using their app, you can check in from your seat on the plane and go straight to the room and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, that cuts out a whole bunch of people that that are currently in the stream there, you know, our front desk clerks in particular and others as well. So, but that's not a robot. That's an app, you know, and we're seeing more of these apps coming in that are doing our work in different areas. You know, they're rolling out one that does what our housekeeping clerks do in terms of assigning rooms out for cleaning and, you know, to the different cleaners and stuff, and that's going to be, you know, handled through an algorithm and so on. There are robots, yes, and we're worried about those as well, you know, but it's not so simple. It's just it's robots. So this is a coming thing. It's yet to hit us hard, but we're watching it closely. We're seeing it where it is being rolled out across the country and across the world. In Vegas, for example, we see robot bartenders, and we see little R2-D2 things running up to the rooms and delivering things where a human being would do that before. And so we're going to be bargaining this. We're taking it very seriously because it's happening so fast.
So it's on the table this year?
Oh, yeah, and it's on the table in multiple cities, and we've hired our experts, and you know, there's different ways to deal with automation, and of course, automation is nothing particularly new. The difference is it's happening so fast now with this the software design, and you know, then of course, the state and federal governments are gleefully subsidizing the research into making robots that will do our work. You gotta wonder how they think we're gonna be able to pay taxes when there's nobody working.
That was Local 5 union leader Eric Gill talking with us this morning about the issues on the bargaining table as talks with the major hoteliers representing thousands of workers are underway. Gill was talking about NACA, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, and a new housing program it's trying to start here.
One big union, I'm gonna join it by myself. Don't want nobody to join it for me. I'm gonna join one big union by myself. And if that road gets rough and rocky.
This is The Conversation on statewide member supported Hawaii Public Radio. Up next, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking of a certain Hawaiian politician and revolutionary. Born in 1855 on Maui to a Native Hawaiian mother and an American father, he was active in his community and was elected to the Royal Legislature in 1880, representing Wailuku. In 1881, King Kalakaua sent him to the Royal Military Academy in Turin, Italy, as part of the Education of Hawaiian Youths Abroad program. There he married an Italian baroness and eventually returned to Hawaii during a time of great unrest, and he put his military education to the test. In 1888, he planned a coup d'etat to dethrone Kalakaua that never came to fruition. But in 1889, he led a failed rebellion prior to the overthrow of Hawaii. Though found guilty of treason, he was acquitted and went on to become a prominent figure in the Liliuokalani cabinet before passing away in 1903 at the age of 48. Nicknamed the Iron Duke of Hawaii, what was this man's name? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Paddle Sports on Maui, providing sustainable eco-tours with a dedication to using business for environmental and social change. HawaiianPaddleSports.com.
Continuing our look at possible solutions to our housing crisis, HBR reporter Noe Tanigawa shares what's being tried on Maui.
It's so interesting over there, Catherine, because as you and I found out recently, Maui's bigger than you think. They're the second biggest island. They've got 145,000 people in the last census, probably a little more now. Oahu, smaller, and we've got seven times the population. So there's automatically a little bit of perspective for us there. Maui developed so differently, and I gotta mahalo all the people, the real estate agents and other community people who've helped me understand all of this so far, on and off the record, pointing out that, you know, they don't have the big military installations like we do on Oahu. They don't have the manufacturing, no big government operations. So they kind of went from plantation economy to tourism. Blammo, you know? It kind of happened real fast in the 60s and 70s. And so I think it's really good to take a look at that period and see how they were looking at housing. So we got here community activist Lucien Denae. She hosts the Maui Public Access Program Crossroads on Akaku. She kind of points out that affordable housing for resort workers got off to a good start on Maui.
Under the earlier mayors, like Mayor Cravallo, who was the mayor in the 70s, affordable housing for local families was a big priority for him because he was the engineer of the new resort economy, and he knew that the resorts would drive up prices of land. He was a really smart guy. He negotiated with large landowners like, you know, Maui Land and Pine and Alexander and Baldwin and Haleakala Ranch to get land to build affordable units. And then he negotiated with local contractors like Arasumi Brothers. The county just was a broker. They didn't build the housing. Mayor Hannibal Tavares did the same thing.
Ooh, there's mayors getting right in, up to the elbows, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that it certainly gives you a different perspective than Oahu. It's really interesting.
Yeah, because we on Oahu are really starting to wonder whether we can get the affordable housing we need as a percentage of what people feel like building. You know what I mean? Vince Bagoyo was housing director under Tavares. So he was there when they were building some of that housing. Now, a lot of that workforce housing was only affordable for X number of years, 10 years, 15 years. So some of that housing is now the really expensive stuff in some of the best places. Vince Bagoyo, who was housing director under Tavares, says that Maui has a law. For every four hotel or condo units, you've got to build one affordable workforce unit. And he says, you know, that's worked a lot of the time.
We need to provide affordable housing for our workforce. Otherwise, what's happening on Maui, and I think even it's happening throughout the state, there's this gentrification that's taking place that only the offshore buyer, the well-to-do, that are now enjoying the best places that our local people used to live. The old villages before are now being cut into an agricultural state, and it's being bought by offshore people.
Bagoyo's dad was a plantation worker when he came over. And so, like, think back, Catherine.
Right,
plantations, where were they? The plantation villages, especially during Obon season, we think about the villages that were right there. Kapalua, Ka'anapali, Lanipoko, Olowalu, Pu'unene, Pa'ia, these, Lahaina, these were the plantation villages. Wow. That was some life, huh?
Right. And it is pretty startling. I mean, I'm still kind of working on that one fact that Maui is bigger than Oahu.
And it's got such a different layout. You know, they finished their Maui Island plan about 8 years ago now. But their idea was to have these kind of plantation, these towns connected by, you know, open land, ag. And there is a possibility for that there, I realize now. What's happening, though, is that those villages, the various towns that are being connected, are by de facto kind of turning into large agricultural estates bought by offshore people. Like, how did that happen? One good example is the Spencers. It's Jesse and Doug Spencer. They had a track record for development on Maui. They were real estate people and developers. They planned something called the Ohana Kai Development, an 1,100-unit affordable home subdivision that was supposed to go in around Ma'alaya. They met with opposition. Things happened back and forth. They bought the property in 2008. They say they spent about $4 million on development and the planning and everything. Finally, with it all came down to 2016, they gave it up. They decided the cheapest, easiest, most sensible thing for them to do would be to divide that land into 21 ag lots and sell it that way. That's what's happening now. That was tough, and it was a tough fight for all of Maui because, you know, Maui Tomorrow, for example, the Ma'alaya Community Association, they were so concerned about traffic and the injection wells that were proposed there. They said could really damage the offshore sea life. The Spencers said that, you know, it's all these first-generation transplants from the mainland who are not committed to local people and affordable housing are just standing in the way. It was rough, really rough.
Yeah, a lot of tension there.
Ooh, so that's kind of where people get, and I really get the impression that Maui is the developer's least favorite island to build on. So they've succeeded in a way, right? Look what's happened to Oahu since the 60s and 70s.
Right, and that's the concern that the residents have is they don't want to turn into another Oahu.
That's it right there.
But Maui is also at a turning point because all those, well, the sugar industry has basically folded, and you've got all this A and B land, and there are folks that are looking and turning the stone over, and okay, what should we do? How do we carve this out? Where do we go forward?
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting because, as you know, there are some community groups and individuals and families on that island looking to provide different visions for Maui with their parcels. Bagoyo says he thinks the county might have lost its last opportunity to buy a large parcel and develop it. He's working in sort of infill lands, you know, parcels here and there. And, you know, it's really hard to see, Catherine, how affordable housing can be built without a little more government help, especially those for 50% and below the area median income. And I know Maui is now the county council studying how to develop and implement an affordable housing plan. Maybe the county might be able to help with pre-development costs, like somehow make it easier for developers on the front end so that their investment in the planning won't have to be as much.
Well, I know that with this whole housing crisis, it's just exacerbated with the whole vacation rental issue. And I know Maui and Kauai, you know, large whole homes are being turned over for vacation rentals. And then there goes the housing for the local people.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there always is the question, how easy do you want to make it for developers?
And I'm always struck when I go over there is when you see the traffic and all the hotel workers that drive in to go to the resorts, and it's just mind-boggling. You know, it used to be you go to the neighbor islands because there was no traffic, and that's not the case anymore. I think any island you go to, you're going to run into a traffic jam at some point.
At certain times of day. But you know what? I must say, we get slammed for traffic here on Oahu, and I find ways around it. You got to know the island. You know, like the locals know how they can get around a lot of stuff. But yeah, traffic and environmental concerns are two of the big things that communities worry about when they have new developments coming in.
Right, and of course, housing, the biggie.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Noe Tuanikawa, for joining us this morning.
Thanks to you.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we invited gubernatorial candidate Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa to join us.
We'll talk to her about her plans, if she's elected governor, for moving the needle on economic diversity and the technology agenda.
That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
This weekend, candidates for Congressional District 1 gather in HPR studios for a political forum. Today, our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat feature a story about those running for the office and where they sit on the ideological spectrum. Reporter Nick Ruby is taking a break from Washington, D.C., where he's based now, and joins us this morning from the newsroom in Kaimuki. Welcome back, Nick.
Aloha, Catherine. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, so interesting take. I mean, this is really the veterans and the newbies, right, this race?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the field of candidates, I mean, really, you have some folks who have been in politics for a long time. The front runner right now is, at least according to the latest polls, a poll from the Honolulu Star Advertiser is Ed Case, of course, a former congressman. And then we have Doug Chin, former AG and current LG, a lieutenant governor for the state of Hawaii, who, while this is the first time he's running as a candidate, has been around politics in recent years, including as former Honolulu Mayor Peter Carlisle's right-hand man. You also have Donna Mercado Kim, the state senator who was once Senate president, who's been in politics for decades. And then you have people like Kaniela Ng and Beth Fukumoto, both of them who are in politics currently as state representatives and have been for the past several years, but who are young and who are trying to bring more progressive ideas into the Democratic Party right now.
And your story is basically that they're not getting too much traction.
Right. I mean, I think when you look at what's happening with the Democratic Party nationally, you see a lot of people in the party sort of running toward Bernie Sanders and some of the messages that him and that progressive sect of the party have embraced and have been expounding upon over the past several months and years. And I think when you look at the victory of someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez over Joseph Crowley in New York, you see where that message has sort of resonated in a Democratic district. But here in Hawaii, as we're seeing with the polls, that message doesn't seem to be resonating, and that Democratic Socialist message doesn't seem to be resonating as much.
Right, so not so much here. But then also there is a strategy, you know, the new up-and-comers basically join a race to kind of get their name out there. So they really don't maybe expect to win, but at least they'll get their name recognition and with the hopes that down the road they will get into a higher office.
Well, yeah, I think if you ask the candidates themselves, they would tell you that they are in it to win it. I think Kaniela Ng, for instance, believes that the polls aren't accurate, and they were not accurate in the Ocasio-Cortez-Crowley race. But yes, I think there's also something to be said about getting your name out there for the next time you want to run for office or move up the ladder in politics as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Nick. Glad you're back.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thanks again for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, we regularly bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nick Ruby. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Posed a question to our listeners, why is voter turnout so low in Hawaii? And we got a couple of people on our talkback line. Gus called in from the Big Island of Hawaii.
Our education system is so flawed, and people are coming out of high school, they can't hardly read, and they're embarrassed about it. So the classroom sizes have to come down, the teachers need to be paid more, we need to spend less money on defense and more money on educating our kids. And there's a whole group of people on this island, man, that can't read. They need to be educated. We need to revamp the education system. It's really sad. So that's my opinion.
We also heard from another Big Island resident. Carla had this to say.
If you're old enough to know your history or smart enough, you know how delicate democracy is. There's a lot of people out there that are complacent and say things like, I'm not going to vote. problem with voting is that if people don't talk to each other and urge each other to vote and explain why, especially the elders who know history, we are the employers of our public officials. And if we don't take a stand and take responsibility for hiring these people, then they will just walk all over us and we'll end up like Germany in the 30s or other countries that just lost their democracy. It's really important that people talk to each other. It's really important that people get active. Thank you.
Now on the long view, our analyst Neil Milner joins us in studio as we chew on this problem of low voter turnout during election season. So what do you think about what we just heard here from our listeners?
Well, there's one thing I want to talk about in a little bit of detail, and that's the talking to each other. The other part is well-meaning and typical, but it doesn't work very well in increasing voter turnout. That is, you can give people general lectures and general kinds of scolding about complacency and so on, and I'm not saying they're wrong. It's just that it doesn't move the needle very much. When the needle moves and we increase turnout, one of the ways that you do it is not so much what the message is, but who the messenger is. And it turns out, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but it turns out that if you think about the act of voting as an act that's influenced by your friends and neighbors, then you start getting a better sense. That is, one of the ways that you increase voter turnout is to get people to know that their neighbors have voted, and that, and in fact, to tell these people that we're going to tell others whether you vote or not the next time. That's the exaggerated way. It was called shaming. But it's very clear, if you think about why you give money to charity or why you do good deeds, often it's because you have social influence to do it. So that's a very labor-intensive way. The other thing about that is that voting is a habit, and when she talked about the elders, in a sense, that's a pretty correct way. Voting is a habit, but so is non-voting. We know from other studies, and none of these have ever been looked at closely in Hawaii, but we know from other studies in other places that in families where there wasn't voting, the kids, after they grew up, were less likely to vote. In families where there was voting, the kids followed along. You'll learn a lot of stuff when you're a kid, not just by what people tell you, probably more by what your peers and your family does and what you observe. So that's that kind of habitual, what are the other people doing, turns out to be very important. Just one important factor.
Right. I mean, I know I used to really look forward to Election Day. You'd go out to the school and you'd kind of see your neighbors. You had maybe you hooked up with a couple of folks, you know, down the block. And it was just a nice social thing, you know, your civic duty. And you brought the kids along.
Yeah, you did. But this all has to happen well before that time, even to get you to the civic duty, even to get you to park in the intermediate school parking lot and look at the people's slippers underneath, which is always my favorite thing. That's why I continue to vote in a voting booth. I like to see the shoe styles,
okay.
which color slippers. They're mostly older people. That, again, has to do with what happens earlier. And it's not surprising that education and social class is another. You're more likely to vote if you're better educated, if you have more education, and if you're in a higher social class. But it's not so much what you explicitly learned in school. It's not the lack of civics. It's not the lack of history. Something happens as part of your growing up that makes you more attached to the system over time, a greater sense of the fact that you can affect it and that you pay attention to it. And all of those kinds of issues of attachment bring people more likely to vote into the political system. One of the reasons that people that are young, 18 to, say, 21 or even 18 to 30, have low voter turnout, one, they're not in the habit of voting, and two, they're not really attached to the political system yet. You're hearing all this stuff about guns and about Parkland High School, and people have great hopes for that. Maybe yes, maybe no, but it typically takes time for you to become more attached. I don't mean attached in the good sense. You learn about stuff. You pay taxes. You know, you think about the military in more personal sorts of ways.
What about technology? Because, you know, fewer and fewer of our younger people, you know, subscribe to the newspaper or read the newspaper. They go online, they get it online, and there's the push now to do online voting. So how does that factor in?
Technology is overhyped. Not that it's not important. Let's look at one side. People certainly get more information from social media. And there is some research to show that the generation of young adults now may appear to be less active, but they're more active politically in social media generated campaigns. As far as voting is concerned, we know this, that mass email campaigns, get out to vote campaigns, have virtually no effect on turnout. You know, these kind of blanket emails and kind of blanket messages. Now, remember though, that they may not have much of an effect, but they're cheap as heck to do. So it may pay to do something. I guess the important issue is that whatever the changes have been, the youth vote is still about the same as it was before. Certainly campaigns are more social media oriented. All the campaigns now know how to do it. There's sophisticated use of social media and trying to motivate your own voters to come out. But overall, it hasn't really changed voter turnout.
But the efforts then by campaigns to go down and pick up the neighbor and take her over to the polls.
That's the old, oh yeah, we've been doing that for years. The difference in nowadays is, and this is, whatever you know about algorithms and big data and the stuff that Cambridge Analytics and all of these huge macro data things, what that allows you to do is to target much more specifically who's likely to vote for you and who is not. And so you can spend more time targeting these people in different sorts of ways. And so it's, you know, you were always doing it before, but it's the difference between, you know, six aunties and uncles gathering at Zippy's for early morning coffee before they went out and targeted and just went around the district kind of, you know, helter-skelter. Now you identify houses more. So you have, essentially, it's a more sophisticated kind of grassroots campaign. But see, all of that assumes that that what keeps people from voting is access, is in the limitations. And there's certainly some truth to that. And Hawaii is trying to move in that direction by making it easier to register. You can have same-day registration. They try talking about moving to mail ballots and so on. What we know about that in other places is that it does make some difference, but it's not nearly as much a difference as people think it is. And there's some evidence on the mail ballots that, you know, it may even suppress the votes in some area. But I think what we're likely to see if we do that is that access has a certain amount of effect, and it's something that you can do politically and administratively. But it's not a magic bullet by any means. None of this is a magic bullet. It's really hard to change voter turnout because whatever your beliefs are about democracy and participation, the average person tends to look at voting and politics in the context of his or her everyday life, which means that some of them don't think about it at all. Some of them think about it all the time, and lots of people in the middle.
Now, earlier we had talked with one of Civil Beach reporters about a story where they had a candidate focusing on the Micronesian vote and mm-hmm. the young students who were born here who can vote, and it just kind of working on that as a pool, as a voting block for future elections. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. You always have to remember, though, that there are two things about getting out to vote. People like you and me sitting in here talking who are allegedly objective, right, are interested in turning out in voter turnout generally. Politicians are not interested in turning out voter turnout generally. They're interested in turning in increasing the voter turnout for their own purposes. So using the Micronesian youth as an example, you might have some groups just trying to increase the youth, and their ways to target it. And that's probably a manageable kind of project, although it's hard. And the other part is a politician running who really doesn't care, you know, a Democratic legislator running in an area where there are a lot of Micronesians, I say down around Mauiuiui, doesn't really care if they're going to vote Republican, you know. So there is a difference.
Okay, all right. Interesting stuff. All right. But thanks, Neil.
Sure.
And don't forget to vote.
In person.
Yes, that's true. Longview analyst Neil Milner joins us as we chew on this problem of low voter turnout.
Aloha, I'm Elizabeth Mervin from Leeward Theater, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier, we asked listeners to think of the name of a Hawaiian soldier and politician known as the Iron Duke of Hawaii. The man, Robert Kalani Hiapo Wilcox, certainly lived up to that moniker. An alumni of Turin's Royal Military Academy, Wilcox returned to Hawaii as a fierce defender of Hawaiian sovereignty who grew disillusioned with Kalakaua's reign of Hawaii. He organized the failed Wilcox Rebellion in the years leading up to the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Following the rebellion, he enjoyed success as a politician in the royal cabinet of Liliuokalani and eventually remarried to Princess Teresa La'anui. His newspaper, The Liberal, was known for both its strong support of Hawaiian sovereignty and its scathing attacks of the royal family's decadent lifestyle. Robert Wilcox was a fierce critic of foreign interests in Hawaii, and during the unrest of the overthrow, did not hesitate to take up arms for the cause of Hawaiian independence. That is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The one-year anniversary of the fatal Marco Polo high-rise fire has come and gone, though a lawsuit by families of the four victims still hangs overhead. A new fire sprinkler law born out of that tragedy is now in place in an effort to save lives. But there is now some renewed pushback from condo associations. This afternoon, the council's Public Safety Committee takes up a resolution introduced by Councilmember Carol Fukunaga.
It involves the use of what is called a user guide that the fire department came up with kind of explain this is how we're going to be, you know, evaluating all the criteria that are in the life safety evaluation worksheet. And I think some of the factors that they identify in the user guide are things that have been somewhat alarming to a number of condo management companies and board members, you know, as they're preparing to go through this process. For example, one of the things that has caused some concern is the fact that an individual's ability to be able to walk unassisted, you know, down a stairwell, say if you were, you know, in a large condominium property, down 10 stories, 15 stories, et cetera, without any assistance is an area that has elicited some concern. Because particularly for older buildings, you know, you often have older residents. What that means is that there may be a new factor that would otherwise cause condo buildings, you know, to be scored in a way that really demonstrates substantial risk. And then, you know, the condominium buildings may end up being evaluated to have to install sprinklers, which was kind of the opposite of what our bill was intended to accomplish.
Okay, so that's a focus of concern.
That is. And so the resolution we introduced asks the fire department, you know, to explain how they came up with these criteria or conditions, you know, for evaluation, and to really have a lot more public review and feedback on these conditions so that whatever is ultimately going to be used by the fire department is actually vetted by the public and the council, you know, signs off on them.
Right, because, I mean, my understanding was that the associations wanted some choice, but now they may not have much of a choice if the scoring criteria is a lot more tricky.
That's really the biggest area of concern.
Okay.
Where some of the buildings, you know, that had already started to look at who they were going to hire to conduct their, you know, initial life safety evaluations, you know, they're saying, wow, if the scoring is going to be working in a way that ultimately forces us into sprinklers, then we would want to have a level of public review before anything like that materializes.
That was Councilmember Carol Fukunaga talking about a measure asking the fire department to reassess its criteria for determining what fire safety improvements are made to high-rise buildings. Fukunaga wants HFD to hit a pause button on the sprinkler bill. We'll see what happens.
Hi, baby.
Hi.
Next time on The World, the story of a mom and dad trying to raise a family by video chat.
How was school, baby?
They were recently deported to Mexico after building careers, buying a house, and having kids in the U.S.
And you have to eat a very good breakfast before you go to school. No excuse.
Now they're parenting across borders on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
That wraps it up for today. Tell us what you think, suggest a story idea, have an opinion about solutions to our housing problem, or feel strongly about sprinklers and high-rises. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all the past ones available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.